I'm going to start off just by reviewing the picture that I developed last day. So we have G, let's say it's semi-simple, over Q. K is a maximal compact subgroup. Gamma in G of Q is arithmetic. D is G mod K, which is a symmetric space. X is that divided by gamma. And then we have compactifications. Partial compactification of the symmetric space, D bar Borel Serre. And when you divide by gamma, you get X bar Borel Serre. And this maps to D bar reductive Borel Serre. When you divide by gamma, you get X bar reductive Borel Serre. And what I haven't discussed yet is the fact that this also maps to D bar Bailey Borel. When you divide by gamma, you get X bar Bailey Borel. Now, what happens to a single boundary component in this mess? So let's say P is a parabolic subgroup, an arbitrary parabolic subgroup. So it has a decomposition, Langlands decomposition, to UP, AP, MP. Now, the idea is that this corresponds to a single boundary component in the Borel-Serre partial compactification. And that boundary component is obtained by dividing the symmetric space D by AP, by the geodesic action of AP. So we divide by AP and we get a boundary component EP. So this is D divided by AP. Then we further divide by UP, the unipotent radical, and that gives us a reductive Borel-Serre boundary component, which I was calling DP. So this is, if you like, it's P divided by KP, AP. I think you can put the UP on either side, actually, because U is normal. If we divide by gamma, this boundary component gets folded up into a boundary stratum, which I was calling YP. So this is gamma P mod KPAP. This is a Borel-Serre boundary stratum. And remember, dividing by gamma does more than just make identifications in the EP. It also identifies a lot of the EPs together, all the ones for which P is gamma conjugate, all the parabolics which are gamma conjugate to P. And the reductive Borel-Serre stratum is obtained by dividing this one by gamma also. So this is XP, which is, this can also be written, since I'm taking P divided by KP, AP, UP, it's just MP divided by KP. And so this is a gamma M or gamma L into MP mod KP. So what is gamma L? P projects to the Levy, which is AP MP, and that further projects to MP. And so you take gamma, intersect it with P, and push it forward, and that's what gamma sub L is, or gamma sub M. So there's a picture of this. Yeah, so these are strata now. They're not contractible. This is a fiber bundle whose fiber is compact. We are basically dividing by the unipotent radical here. And so on this side you're collapsing the quotient of the unipotent radical divided by gamma to a point. So the fiber is UP mod gamma intersect UP. So that's a compact nil manifold. So So this is a fiber bundle, smooth fiber bundle with a compact fiber. So the picture is something like this. It's more like a schematic picture because you need more dimensions than we have blackboard space for. But I want to think of this as a face of a cube where EP is in the front face and D is the interior of the cube, and the geodesic action is along lines that come into the front. So if you recall, what happened is we glued the front face of this cube onto the symmetric space by limits of these geodesics. And so the case I'm looking at here is when AP is one-dimensional. I mean, it gets messy when AP is higher dimensional. It means that P is a higher co-rank parabolic, and you have to worry about all the boundary components of boundary components, which fit together, which I tried to describe yesterday, which nobody understood. So let's just take the case that we're talking about a co-rank one stratum. So EP is what you get by adding these limit points to the geodesics that go off in this direction. So that means that this direction here is the AP direction. Now, you can think of this as a piece of the symmetric space, or if you like, you can think of it as a piece of what happens after you divide by gamma. For example, I could think of identifying the top face and the bottom face, making these vertical lines into circles, identifying the left face and the right face, making circles in that direction as well. So we'd have something that's sort of compact. So the AP direction is like this, and we attach EP to the front. Let's imagine this direction as being the MP direction. So the Borel's, and let's imagine the vertical direction as being the UP direction. So UP acts along its vertical fibers. So the Borel-Serre boundary component is some complicated product of an MP symmetric space times a UP symmetric space, times a nil manifold. And in the reductive Borel-Serre stratum, we collapse these nil manifolds to points. And it only leaves this piece left as a stratum. So let me remark, this is a manifold with boundary. The front face is a boundary, or a piece of manifold with boundary. The front face is a boundary. But after collapsing, so this is the Borel-Serre, either partial compactification of D or a piece of the compactification of X. And then after collapsing, you get something that looks like this. My blackboard artistry is pretty poor, but anyway, you can probably get the idea. So after collapsing, all the nil manifolds along the front face have been collapsed to points, and it just leaves this stratum, MP, right here. MP mod KP. It just leaves this stratum. The A still moves in this direction. The rest of the symmetric space has been unchanged, but we have this picture. And now let's look at what happens near a point here. A point now has a neighborhood of the following sort: a product with a little disk along the stratum with something that looks like this, which is the nil manifold, UP mod gamma UP, if you divide by gamma, and the cone over that nil manifold. So a point X in the stratum XP has a neighborhood which is homeomorphic to a ball of dimension R, where this is the dimension of XP, crossed with the cone on this nil manifold, gamma U, I guess, yeah, gamma sub UP into UP. And this says that this is a stratified space. Stratified spaces are spaces which are divided into smooth manifolds each of which is considered a stratum, and each point has to have a neighborhood, which is of the type of ball across the cone on some other space, which is called the link. The link of the stratum. So in the notes, I made a few more remarks about stratified spaces, but the stratified structure of this reductive Brel-Serre compactification just falls out of the picture. If there are more boundary strata, the link is more complicated. So in other words, the reductive Brel-Serre compactification is a nice stratified space. And it's a space for which you can understand the singularities because we understand the links of the strata. The link here is just a compact nil manifold. The Brel-Serre compactification is a manifold with boundary, or a manifold with corners, actually. In the higher rank case, if there are several strata, we'll have something like this, a picture where XP is the small stratum, XQ is a larger stratum, XQ prime is a larger stratum. Did I say, last day, I'm not sure I did, the closure of a stratum, XP, in the reductive Brel-Serre compactification is itself the reductive Brel-Serre compactification of that stratum. So XP closure is equal to XP bar RBS. So what's happening here? The closure of XQ is the reductive Brel-Serre compactification of XQ. So that means that near XP, we have this picture where there's a nil manifold sitting right here, and a neighborhood which is a product of a disk in the XP direction, which you might think of as coming out of the blackboard, with the cone over a nil manifold. And that nil manifold is obtained by, it's the standard complicated thing. Q is a parabolic subgroup. It gives rise to a parabolic subgroup of the Levy of P, and then you take the unipotent radical of that, and that's that nil manifold. And the same thing here. There's a nil manifold in this stratum. This point has a neighborhood in the closure of this stratum, which is a disk crossed with the cone over another nil manifold. But there's also the larger nil manifold, UP mod gamma UP. So that's some other larger nil manifold sitting out here, like that. Think of it as like a torus. And there's a fibration of this manifold over that nil manifold and of this nil manifold over that nil manifold. And the result is that this point has a neighborhood which is a cone over this whole object. So the link of X in XP, in the case of co-rank 2, is there's a nil manifold for P, a nil manifold for PQ, a nil manifold for PQ prime, and you take the mapping cone of this map and the mapping cone of that map and you glue them together. And so on. The links of higher codimension strata can also be equally described in terms of a space you construct over a simplex with various identifications. So it's an extremely explicit singular space, and the analysis of its topology involves the study of these nil manifolds. Okay, how about the map to the Bailey-Brel compactification? Well, there's an obvious problem here. The Bailey-Brel compactification has strata which I told you corresponded to maximal parabolic subgroups, at least when the group is simple. On the other hand, these other guys have strata corresponding to all parabolic subgroups. So obviously some strata appear to be missing, but they're not. I just used the maximal parabolic subgroups as a convenient way to describe the strata. But in fact, if you recall, the Dinkin diagram for a simple when G is simple, has to look like this if we're going to get a Hermitian symmetric space. Now, An arbitrary parabolic subgroup is obtained by throwing out some of the dots. So let's throw out some of these dots. And so that means that the, so this is P, or actually L, the levy of P then, breaks up into pieces that look like this. The levy of P is a product of a Hermitian factor and a bunch of linear factors, LP1 perhaps, LP2. And it's the Hermitian factor which gives rise to the symmetric space for the Bailey-Borel compactification. So this P, in this case, the MP, UP, well, let's see, it's actually the APMP, which breaks up into LPH times LPL, and this LPL is the product of smaller factors, product of what you might call linear factors. And the LPH has a symmetric space, LPH mod KPH mod gamma PH. And that's the stratum XF in the Bailey-Borel compactification. So this goes down to F, which is PH mod, sorry, LPH mod KPH, and it goes to XF, which is gamma PH into LPH mod KPH. Well, what maximal parabolic was I using to identify that stratum with yesterday? There is a unique maximal parabolic with the same Hermitian factor. Namely, it's this one. And now I leave out the first of these dots, but I put in all the others. This is the Q, which I was using to identify the stratum in the Bailey-Borel compactification. And now you can see all these dots here, so the pre-image of this stratum, XF, has lots of strata in it, all corresponding to these different choices of ways to break up this linear factor. So here's LQH and LQL. LQL gave rise to a self-adjoint homogeneous cone. In the case of the symplectic group, it was the cone of positive definite symmetric matrices. And all these other parabolic subgroups correspond to boundary components of that cone. And so the result then, finally, is a theorem. If X is in XF, then the pre-image of X in the reductive Borel-Serre compactification, so let's call this map pi, is the reductive Borel-Serre compactification of the arithmetic quotient. Of the cone L Q L mod K Q L mod gamma Q L K A. Oh, okay. So there's a cone, and all these different strata combine to give the boundary components of that cone, and they exactly account for the reductive Borel-Serre compactification of that cone. I discussed last day the standard compactification of the cone, but in fact, that's right, the fiber is not Hermitian. Yeah, and reductive Borel-Serre, thank you. Yes, that's right. Yeah, this LQ, its symmetric space is not Hermitian, the cone is not Hermitian. The fiber of this map is not complex, and in fact, the reductive Borel-Serre compactification doesn't admit a complex structure. It has strata even of odd codimension, of odd dimension as well. Okay, so Now I finished what I was going to do yesterday. Now I want to discuss cohomology. So, flavors of cohomology. There's about 31 different flavors of cohomology. The first is group cohomology. So if you have a group, gamma, let's say a discrete group, then there's the notion of the cohomology of gamma. There's a lot of different ways to describe it. It's a derived functor of invariance, if you like, or there's a complex you can make, I of gamma, I plus 1 of gamma. You can make a complex out of maps of gamma cross gamma to the complex numbers and so on. But if gamma acts freely on a contractible space, then this is also the cohomology of the quotient of that space. So if gamma acts freely on a contractible space, D, then HI of gamma is HI of the quotient, which is also called D gamma by the topologists. And that's just the situation we're in if gamma is an arithmetic group and D is the symmetric space, provided gamma is torsion-free. If gamma is not torsion-free, then it doesn't act free, but it acts with finite stabilizers, and at least rationally, with rational coefficients, you'll still get the right answer. So the result, and you can do the same thing with any representation as well. If you have a finite dimensional representation, then it gives rise to a local system on D mod gamma. And so, say, if lambda maps gamma to GL of V is a finite dimensional representation, then HI of gamma V is HI of D mod gamma E, where E is the local system V cross over gamma with D. You can do the same thing with a local system. So the result is that HI of X is equal to the cohomology of gamma in our cases. And now we have a great application of the Borel-Serre compactification. This is finite dimensional. There's a risk that it might not be. First, let me say, if gamma is a finite group, the cohomology of gamma goes on forever. Secondly, there is a risk that it might not be finite dimensional because this quotient X, after dividing by gamma, might have sort of infinitely much topology as you go off to infinity. But because of Borel-Serre, we know that X is contained inside a manifold with boundary, a compact manifold with boundary, and this can be triangulated with finitely many simplices. So the cohomology is finite dimensional. There are other applications of the Borel-Serre compactification that I should have looked up before this talk. Well, the next flavor of cohomology I want to discuss is Lie algebra cohomology. Durham cohomology. HI of X is also equal to the cohomology of the complex of differential forms. Complex of smooth differential forms on X. a theorem of Cartan, which is usually called Durand's theorem. Let's call it omega dot of x. And so the next flavor of... the compactification is a manifold with boundary, and it's homotopy equivalent to x. So thanks. Yeah, so they both have the same cohomology. Then you can take a subgroup of takes a bit of work. You have a subgroup of finite index, and so there's a covering which is finite. It takes a bit of work, but it's not hard. A subgroup of finite index will always act freely. And so from that, you can conclude that gamma has finite dimensional cohomology. So then there's something called Lie algebra cohomology, relative Lie algebra cohomology of the module of C infinity functions on G mod gamma. And so I'm not going to describe this in detail, but you take the exterior algebra of G and you use K in a certain way. It acts on this module, then you get a complex, and you take the kernel of D, module the image of D, and you get cohomology. So there's something called relative Lie algebra cohomology of this module, and that turns out that the complex that you get is actually just the complex of differential forms on X, and its cohomology is the cohomology of X. Unfortunately, this is a pretty messy module, and so there's another module which is somewhat another G module which is somewhat easier to understand, and that's the module of L2 functions. This is something that Arthur was basically talking about. I mean, he was studying the Adelic version of this, but anyway, it's the module that Arthur was talking about, and there's interesting representation theory in trying to decompose this into irreducible submodules. And when you do decompose it, that means this cohomology will decompose as well, and so we'll get this will get decomposed into pieces. Well, the same argument that says that this is the same as the cohomology of the smooth differential forms on X says that this group is isomorphic to the cohomology of L2 differential forms on X. So we define omega I2 of X to be, so you have to choose an invariant Riemannian metric on X for this. You take a K invariant Hermitian product at the base point and move it around by G, and you get a G invariant Hermitian metric on X. So this is a set of all smooth differential forms on X with the property that in the integral of omega wedge star omega is finite, and the integral of d omega wedge star d omega is finite. And then you take, so because I made the same condition on d as I made on omega, we get a complex omega 2 of X goes to omega I plus 1, 2 of X, and so on. And then the cohomology of this is called the L2 cohomology. And then it's a formal fact that this GK cohomology of the L2 module is equal to the L2 cohomology of X. And you can do the same thing with a local system if you want. So we have to choose an invariant Hermitian metric on X, and then that gives rise to a star operator on differential forms. So this is a star operator from invariant metric. It's known that in the case when X is Hermitian, this is finite dimensional. And more generally, if the group G has a discrete series, this is finite dimensional. But it's not always. For GLN, n greater than or equal to 3, it's infinite dimensional. So here's a really weird thing. You have this L2 cohomology, which depends in some sense on growth rates of forms as you go out to infinity. And this equation says it's also related to the representation theory of G. And moreover, this module decomposes into pieces, and that gives you a decomposition of the L2 cohomology of X into pieces, which is called the spectral decomposition. So we obtain spectral decomposition of the L2 cohomology of X. You don't have to in this case. It doesn't matter. You get the same answer in this case. If you take smooth differential forms, then I think the image is closed already. But there's a lot of work in that, and people have studied this question a lot. But I think in this case, you get the same answer. I think the image is already closed, roughly because the boundary in the Bailey-Borel compactification is so small. So then Zucker in 1980 conjectured that this L2 cohomology of X should be isomorphic to the intersection cohomology, not of X, but of the Bailey-Borel compactification of X. So this is another amazing statement, because here we have something which depends on growth rates of differential forms, and here we have something which is a topological invariant of a compact space, and it's this particular compactification. So this whole path going from representation theory to topology is through a series of identifications. And let me just remark that if we were discussing a Shimura variety instead of a G mod K mod gamma, then this would be the Bailey-Borel compactification of a Shimura variety, which then has a model over a number field, which could then be reduced modulo a prime. And then you would also get this essentially equal to the intersection Eital cohomology of the variety over finite field. So there's also an Eital version here. And on the intersection Eital cohomology, there's a Galois action. And so we have in some sense, I'm speaking very roughly now, but we have a path from infinite dimensional representation theory to Galois modules, which is part of what this whole conference is supposed to be about. But I don't have time to explain the details, and I don't understand the details anyway. Okay, Zucker conjecture was proven. For a long time, it looked like it was going to be proven case by case. Zucker proved one case, then Borel proved another case, then Zucker proved another case, then Borel and Kaslin proved another case, then Zucker proved another case. And then out of the blue, Loingha proved the whole thing, and at the same time, Safer and Stern proved the whole thing. And they proved it by completely different techniques. Yeah. Yeah. The Bailey-Borel compactification only exists for X Hermitian. So a priori it only makes sense for X Hermitian. However, there are more cases for which it's known, but they would take a while for me to describe. There are certain cases where this is also isomorphic to the intersection Kalman through the reductive Borel-Serre compactification, some even non-Hermitian cases. But it's but the non-Hermitian cases are suddenly the story becomes much murkier. So well, they prove more. The L2 cohomology is the cohomology actually of a complex of sheaves. So not only do we have a chain complex, we actually have a sheaf of L2 forms on X bar Bailey Borel. And the intersection cohomology is also the cohomology of a complex of sheaf of sheaves. Sheaf IC dot. Now, I'm not sure how much to say about sheaves, but let me just I'll try to say a few words about the L2 sheaf. You'd like to make this into a sheaf. So the obvious thing to do is for any open set in X bar Bailey Borel, define sections of U and some sheaf S dot to be the set of all differential forms in U intersect X, such that the integral of omega wedge star omega is finite, and the integral of d omega with star d omega is finite. I want a sheaf on the Bailey-Borel compactification, but it's got to be a sheaf of differential forms, so the forms have to live on the non-singular part, on X itself. So for each open set, we take forms in that open set intersected with the interior, X, which are L2. Well, this, as I wrote it, isn't a sheaf. You have to sheafify this. This is a pre-sheaf, so then you have to sheafify it. Now, sheafification does some pretty horrible things. For example, let's just look on X itself. What happens if I sheafify this? So let's imagine restricting this just to X. I mean, the question everybody says is, why don't you just take the sheaf of L2 differential forms on X? For each open set, you have the differential forms like this. You sheafify it, you get a sheaf on X. But strangely enough, if you do that, you just get the you get the same as all differential forms on X after you sheafify this. The reason is, sheaves have this property that if you have an arbitrary union of open sets, which can be infinite, and if you have a section over each open set, and those sections agree on the intersections, then that comes from a section on the whole thing. So if I take any smooth differential form on X, the point is I can cover X with open sets that have compact closure. Infinitely many, but it doesn't matter. I can cover X with open sets with compact closure, and then any differential form on X will have the property that in each of these it will be L2, because the closure is compact. And so the form is bounded on that open set. And so I'll have a section of this sheaf. So the original form will be a section of that sheaf, but the form itself has no L2 property at all. It's just smooth. So the sheafification of this has the property, so let's call this the sheaf omega 2 dot, has the property that its restriction, omega 2 dot restricted to X, is equal to omega dot of X, the sheaf of all differential forms, all smooth forms. But on the compactification, that's not the case. On the compactification, you have a singular stratum. And now if I take a little neighborhood of that singular stratum, I can imagine that the differential forms can grow arbitrarily badly as I get to the edge of that neighborhood, but around the stratum, you've still got that L2 condition. So near each stratum, the forms still have a a restriction. And it turns out that this sheaf omega 2 is fine. When you want to take the, when you go to take the cohomology of a complex of sheaves, S0, S1, S2, suppose you have a complex of sheaves, you'd like to take the cohomology of the complex of sheaves by just looking at the global sections. But you're not allowed to do that unless the sheaves are fine. For example, if I take the constant sheaf on a manifold, its global sections is just the constants. The problem is the constant sheaf isn't fine. So you have to replace it with a complex of sheaves, each of which is fine. Like, for example, the differential forms. And then when you take the global sections, it will give you the right cohomology. So this sheaf is fine, but the theorem is that this L2 sheaf is fine. This is a theorem of Zucker. Fine means that they have partitions of unity, yeah. And so this implies that the cohomology of X bar Bailey Borel with coefficients in the sheaf omega 2 is equal to the cohomology of global sections. And the global sections are exactly the L2 differential forms. So this is the L2 cohomology. So here's a sheaf which gives you the L2 cohomology, but it's a sheaf on the compactification. And similarly over here, the intersection cohomology is a sheaf too, which I described in the notes in some detail, but I'll just tell you the idea. The idea is that on each stratum of the Bailey-Borel compactification, there sits a policeman, and he watches the form when it comes in. And he counts its dimension. It say, he says, if the dimension of that form is too big in the directions I can't see, the directions that are coming into the stratum, then the form's not allowed. And so he throws out various forms, and the result is that the stock cohomology of the intersection cohomology sheaf is zero if I is greater than or equal to the complex codimension of the stratum containing X. And the stock cohomology with compact supports so that's HI brackets X IC dot is zero if I is less than or equal to the same number. Stock cohomology in this case can be computed just by taking one of these little open sets. Remember I said we had a stratification. Each point has a neighborhood of the form of a disk or an open ball crossed with the cone on some space which is called the link. You take one of those open sets and just look at the intersection cohomology of that open set or the intersection cohomology with compact supports of that open set. And that will be the stock cohomology and stock cohomology with compact supports. And you can calculate that it vanishes in these ranges. And moreover, those conditions in some sense uniquely determine intersection cohomology. And these conditions determine the intersection cohomology sheaf in an appropriate category. Of sheaves, which is called the derived category. And so, because of this fact, in order to prove the Zucker conjecture, you have to prove that the L2 cohomology has the same properties, that the stock cohomology, the L2 cohomology vanishes above the middle dimension, and that the compactly supported stock cohomology vanishes below that dimension. And that may sound easy, but it's not. But that is how the proof, how both proofs of Leuenha and of Sapir-Whorf go. They prove that these vanishing conditions hold for intersection cohomology. I mean, for L2 cohomology. Pardon me? So in other words, so X has a good neighborhood, which is homeomorphic to a ball of dimension R, where R is the dimension of the stratum containing X, crossed with the cone on some space L, just as we saw with the reductive Borel serre. And then the stock cohomology X of the IC is equal to the intersection cohomology of this neighborhood, piece of X. And the cohomology with compact supports of IC is equal to the intersection cohomology with compact supports of piece of X. So these sheaves are nice, and it's also true of the L2 cohomology. These sheaves are nice in that you don't have to go to the limit over smaller and smaller open sets. You can stop as soon as you get to one of these nice sets, and you'll get the right answer for stock cohomology. Finally, I'd like to just mention briefly a sheaf on the reductive Borel serre compactification, which is also relevant to the whole picture. There's a sheaf called the weighted cohomology, an X bar reductive Borel serre. So the weighted cohomology is constructed much in the same way as the intersection cohomology is. A policeman stands on every stratum and he watches the form as it comes into the stratum. However, near the stratum in the reductive Borel serre compactification, we have this group. So if XP is a stratum, we have this group AP, the torus that acts near that stratum. And so the policeman looks at the differential form that's coming in and asks, what weight does it have with respect to this torus? And if the weight is too small, he says, you can't come into the stratum. And if the weight is large, then it's allowed to come into the stratum. So the weighted cohomology is a truncation, as the intersection cohomology is. It causes the cohomology to vanish in a certain range, but it's a truncation by weights rather than by degrees. So it's a weight truncation. Of the sheaf omega dot of smooth differential forms. So I said a few more words about this in the notes, and there are references for the construction of this cohomology theory. And there's a certain weight which is chosen, which we call the middle weight. And so for the middle, so I'm talking about the middle weighted cohomology. And then there's a theorem that, I guess I erased. We have a mapping from the reductive Borel serre compactification to the Bailey-Borel compactification. And there's a theorem that if we take the weighted cohomology sheaf here and push it down to get a sheaf on the Bailey-Borel compactification, what you get is isomorphic to the intersection cohomology sheaf. And in particular, it means that the cohomology of this sheaf is the same as the intersection cohomology of this sheaf, which, as you recall, is the same as the L2 cohomology of X. So this gives another way of calculating the L2 cohomology of X, but on the reductive Borel-Serre compactification. So we have this long list of isomorphisms that this is also the weighted cohomology of the reductive Borel-Serre compactification. Now, the reason we did this is because Arthur has a formula. Pardon?
The weighted cohomology of the derived category?
Yeah. These are, I just didn't want to say all that. These are all elements of the derived category. Right. Yeah. In particular, it's a complex of sheaves. I get so used to saying sheaf that I should say mean complex of sheaves. And it's obtained by starting with the complex of differential forms and truncating each of the pieces separately. So Arthur has a formula for the action of a Hecke correspondence on the L2 cohomology. So let me just say quickly about Hecke correspondence. If G is in GQ, then we get a new subgroup gamma prime equals gamma intersected with G inverse gamma G. Take the conjugate of gamma intersected with gamma. This will be a subgroup of finite index in both of these. And so we get a mapping of D mod gamma prime to D mod gamma, a covering, in fact, which is a finite covering. But we also get a covering of D mod G inverse gamma G, the conjugate group, which is also finite. But these are isomorphic, given by multiplication by G. So we have two coverings of D mod gamma, and this is, so we have what you might think of as a correspondence on D mod gamma. So here's X cross X. And the image of this will be, instead of being the graph of a function, it's the graph of a multivalued function, or a correspondence. You can think of it as being a subset of X cross X. And now, this acts on differential forms. You take a differential form here, you pull it back this way, and then you push it forward this way. Since this map is finite, it just means adding over the fibers. And that means also that an L2 differential form will be taken to an L2 differential form. So it preserves L2, and so we have a mapping, Hecke mapping from HI2 of X to itself, and so we have a Lefschetz number, which is the alternating sum of the traces of H on HI2 of X. So because the L2 cohomology is the same as the GK cohomology of the L2 functions, and because Arthur has a trace formula, which he discussed over the last month, he applied it to this correspondence. I should say there's a particular element f. You know, he has this test function f all the time. So this Hecke correspondence corresponds to a particular function f, and as a result, he gets a formula, which looks like this. There's a bunch of sums, and then there's some integrals, and then there's some discrete series characters, and so on. I guess you've seen those by now. And so you can ask, well, we have a correspondence. Could this be the Lefschetz fixed point formula for this correspondence? But the first problem is X is not compact. So is this a Lefschetz fixed point formula in some sense? Well, the first problem is that X is not compact, and there do not exist Lefschetz. I mean, you can't hope for a Lefschetz fixed point formula in the non-compact case. For example, map C to C by Z goes to Z plus 1. This doesn't have any fixed points, but its Lefschetz number is 1. So you can't write this Lefschetz fixed point formula as a sum over fixed points of local contributions from each fixed point. What do you do here? You have to compactify this. There's a fixed point at infinity of this map, and that fixed point at infinity has index 2, and so using that you can figure out that this has Lefschetz number 1. So we need a compactification. And your first guess is because of the Zicker conjecture, you should use the Bailey-Borel compactification and the intersection cohomology. And we tried to do that, and we just didn't see what to do. So now I'm talking about joint work, by the way, with Robert McPherson and also Kottwitz. And some of it is work with Harder. It was with Harder that we developed the weighted cohomology. So we tried to see what to do on the Bailey-Borel compactification. The singularities are awful. It's a very complicated space. And by the way, if you look at Arthur's formula, the very first sum here, as you all know, is a sum over all parabolic subgroups, not a sum over maximal parabolic subgroups. So it looks like Arthur's formula is giving you a sum over the reductive Borel-Serre compactification, not over the Bailey-Borel compactification. And so that's exactly what happened. The result is that the answer is yes, but you have to use the reductive Borel-Serre compactification, and on that you use the weighted cohomology sheaf, which I mentioned. Yes, you're using the weighted cohomology sheaf. On X bar reductive Borel-Serre. So first you get a formula. It takes a lot of work to get it, and it doesn't look at all like Arthur's formula. But then you have to group the fixed points together in a certain way. And when they're grouped together and you do more work, then it's possible to take each term and see that every term in Arthur's formula corresponds to a collection of fixed points. And so you get again an interpretation of Arthur's formula as a Lefschetz fixed point theorem, and also generalizations to all these other weighted cohomology theories. In the notes I give some references where you can read about this, but it's a long story. Okay, I think I'll quit.